Active, 579. Midland County, 3,495 confirmed, 78 deaths. In Texas, 3,249 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 16th, 355 less than a week ago. They occupy 5.5% of hospital beds. 3,409 new cases were reported on September 16th, 28,981 more than a week ago. 14,478 Texans have died as of September 16th, 135 more deaths reported than a day before, and 786 more than a week ago. Here are some coronavirus headlines. Another 860,000 Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week. Nearly 3.5 million Texans have filed for unemployment relief since mid-March. Vaccine timeline. Even if a vaccine for COVID-19 was released now, it would take 6 to 9 months for enough people to receive it to create immunity, the U.S. CDC director said. Trump on Wednesday called on congressional Republicans to support a massive economic relief bill with much higher numbers and stimulus payments for Americans, abruptly proposing an entirely different plan from what the Senate GOP sought to advance in recent days. Alarming numbers of low-income students are dropping out of college because they lack adequate Wi-Fi for online classes. Michael Caputo, the Department of Health and Human Services' top communications official, is going on medical leave after urging Trump's supporters to prepare for an armed insurrection and accusing scientists in his own agency of sedition. NCAA delays start of basketball season 2 weeks, plans no changes to postseason tournament. Tip-off for the men's and women's Division I college basketball seasons was moved to November 25th. Carnival is selling 18 cruise ships amid financial struggles and the CDC's no-sale order. North Carolina GOP candidate for governor campaigns on overturning mask mandate and reopening schools. Courts may reconsider temporary coronavirus restrictions as pandemic drags on. Top health officials say states need about $6 billion from Congress to distribute coronavirus vaccine. Poll workers in Missouri County told to act surprised if confronted about lack of masks. New voter registrations plummeted during the pandemic in Texas, where you can't register online. Texas Supreme Court again blocks Harris County from sending mail-in ballot applications to all voters. Now we'll turn to a couple of stories that I will be reading. From CNN Health, a pandemic upshot. Seniors are having second thoughts about where to live. By Judith Graham, Kaiser Health News. Where do we want to live in the years ahead? Older adults are asking this question anew in light of the ongoing toll of the coronavirus pandemic. Disrupted lives, social isolation, mounting deaths. Many are changing their minds. Some people who plan to move to senior housing are now choosing to live independently rather than communally. Others wonder whether transferring to a setting where they can get more assistance might be the right call. These decisions, hard enough during ordinary times, are now fraught with uncertainty as the economy falters and COVID-19 deaths climb, including tens of thousands in nursing homes and assisted living centers. Teresa Ignacio Gonzalvo and her husband Jaime, both 68, chose to build a house rather than move into a continuing care retirement community when they relocate from Virginia Beach, Virginia, to Indianapolis later this year to be closer to their daughters. Having heard about lockdowns around the country because of the coronavirus, Gonzalo said, "We realized we're not ready to lose our independence." Alyssa Ballett, 64, is planning to leave her 750-square-foot apartment in downtown Chicago and put down roots in a multi-generational co-housing community where neighbors typically share dining and recreation areas and often help one another. What I've learned during this pandemic is that Personal relationships matter most to me, not place, she said. Kim Beckman, 64, and her husband Mike were ready to give up being homeowners in Victoria, Texas, and join a 55-plus community or rent in an independent living apartment building in northern Texas before COVID-19 hit. Now they're considering buying an even bigger home, because if you're going to be in the house all the time, you might as well be comfortable, Beckman said. Everyone I know is talking about this, said Wendell Cornfield, 71, who lives on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. She has temporarily tabled the prospect of moving into a continuing care retirement community being built in the Bronx. My husband and I are going to play it by ear. We want to see how things play out with the pandemic, she said. In Cornfield circles, people are more committed than ever to staying in their homes or apartments as long as possible, at least at the moment. Their fear, if they move into a senior living community, they might be more likely to encounter a COVID-19 outbreak. All of us heard about the huge number of deaths in senior facilities, Cornfield said. But people who stay in their own homes may have trouble finding affordable help there when needed, she acknowledged. Avoiding nursing homes amid the pandemic. More than 70,000 residents and staff members in nursing homes and assisted living facilities had died of COVID-19 by mid-August, according to the latest count from the Kaiser Family Foundation. This is an undercount, because less than half of states are reporting data for COVID-19 in assisted living. Nor is data reported for people living independently in senior housing. Kaiser Health News is an editorially independent program of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Nervousness about senior living has spread as a result, and in July, the National Investment Center for Seniors Housing and Care reported the lowest occupancy rates since the research organization started tracking data 14 years ago. Occupancy dropped more in assisted living, a 3.2% decline from April through June, compared with January through March, than in independent living, a 2.4% decline. The organization doesn't compile data on nursing homes. In a separate NIC survey of senior housing executives in August, 74% of families had voiced concerns about moving in as COVID cases spiked in many parts of the country. Overcoming possible isolation. The potential for social isolation is especially worrisome as facilities retain restrictions on family visits and on group dining and activities. While states have started to allow visits outside at nursing homes and assisted living centers, most facilities don't yet allow visits inside, a situation that will increase frustration when the weather turns cold. Beth Burham Mace, NIC's chief economist and director of outreach, emphasized that operators have responded aggressively by instituting new safety and sanitation protocols, moving programming online, helping residents procure groceries and other essential supplies, and communicating regularly about COVID-19, both on-site and in the community at large, much more regularly. Mary Kozlowski, 76, resides in an independent living at Heron's Key, a continuing care retirement community in Gig Harbor, Washington, which is doing all this and more with a sister facility, Emerald Heights, in Redmond, Washington. We all feel safe here, she said. Even though we're strongly advised not to go into each other's apartments, at least we can see each other in the hall and down in the lobby and down on the decks outside. As far as isolation, you're isolating here with over 200 people. There's always somebody around. One staff member at Heron's Key tested positive for COVID-19 in August, but has recovered. 20 residents and staff members tested positive at Emerald Heights. 2 residents and 1 staff member died. Colin Milner, chief executive officer of the International Council on Active Aging, stresses that some communities are doing a better job than others. His organization recently published a report on the future of senior living in light of the pandemic. It calls on operators to institute a host of changes, including establishing safe visiting areas for families, both inside and outside, providing high-speed internet services throughout communities, and ensuring adequate supplies of masks and other forms of personal protective equipment for residents and staff, among other recommendations. Some families now wish they had arranged for older relatives to receive care in a more structured environment before the pandemic started. They're finding that older relatives living independently, especially those who are frail or have mild cognitive impairments, are having difficulty managing on their own. I'm hearing from a lot of people, mostly older daughters, that we waited too long to move mom or dad. We had our head in the sand. Can you help us find a place for them? Said Ali Maza, who owns Brandywine Concierge Senior Services in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. While many operators instituted move-in moratoriums early in the pandemic, most now allow new residents, as long as they test negative for COVID-19. Quarantines of up to 2 weeks are also required before people can circulate in the community. Many older adults, however, simply don't have the financial means to make a move. More than half of middle-income seniors, nearly 8 million older adults, can't afford independent living or assisted living communities, according to a 2019 study. And more than 7 million seniors are poor, according to the Federal Supplemental Poverty Measure, which includes out-of-pocket medical expenses and other drains on cash reserves. Questions to ask. For those able to consider senior housing, experts suggest you ask several questions. How is the facility communicating with residents and families? Has it had a COVID outbreak? Is it disclosing COVID cases and deaths? Is it sharing the latest guidance from federal, state, and local public health authorities? What protocols have been instituted to ensure safety? I'd want to know, do they have a plan in place for disasters? Not just the pandemic, but also floods, fires, hurricanes, blizzards, Milner said. And beyond a plan, do they have supplies in place? How does the community engage residents? Is online programming, exercise classes, lectures, interest group meetings available? Are one-on-one interactions with staffers possible? Are staffers arranging online interactions via FaceTime or Zoom with family? Are family visits allowed? Social engagement and stimulation are more important than ever, said David Schless, president of the American Seniors Housing Association. What's the company's financial status and occupancy rate? Properties with occupancy rates of 90% or higher are going to be able to withstand the pressures of COVID-19 significantly more than properties with occupancy below 80%, in my opinion, said Mace of the National Investment Center for Seniors Housing and Care. Higher occupancy means more revenues, which allows institutions to better afford extra expenses associated with the pandemic. Transparency is very important, Schless says. Now we're going to move into financial articles. The first I'm going to read myself, it's from the Associated Press and was published September 14th. American Airlines holding off decision to cut some flights. Fort Worth. American Airlines confirmed Monday it is holding off on its decision to cut flights to Stillwater, Oklahoma, and Roswell, New Mexico, but warned that slumping demand in some markets is forcing the company to consider difficult decisions to right-size our airline. American announced last month it was planning to drop flights to 15 smaller U.S. cities when a federal requirement to serve those communities ends. But the company said in a statement it is deferring its decision on Roswell and Stillwater while conversations are ongoing with local officials. While our flights to Stillwater and Roswell are among those that have suffered when it comes to demand and profitability, we have been in touch with local officials and we're deferring our decision to suspend service to those markets as those conversations are ongoing, the airline said. The airline blamed low demand during the coronavirus pandemic and the failure of Congress to extend the federal payroll support program. Among the other cities targeted for dropping flights in October are Del Rio. The company notified the Federal Department of Transportation on August 28th that maintaining services to Joplin and Sioux City is not financially viable in this environment, and that it planned to discontinue all services to those airports by December 1st. The airline reported that since the pandemic began in the spring, American's operations in Joplin and Sioux City produced losses of $2.2 million and $1.9 million, respectively. Now, we're going to do something a little different today. There are some articles from our local newspapers that our volunteers have already read. These have been read within the last 2 weeks or so, that we have not had time to run in our regular newspaper program, but we have saved those because they fit into the format of this show. Our first article is going to continue the theme from the airlines. Southwest Airlines CEO doesn't expect travel to pick up until 2021. This was originally published from the Midland Reporter-Telegram Tuesday, September 8th.
Southwest Airlines CEO doesn't expect travel to pick up until 2021. By Kyle Arnold, Dallas Morning News. Going into the office every day, Southwest Airlines CEO Gary Kelly describes the Dallas headquarters atmosphere as feeling a bit like the Mountain Hotel from the 1980s horror flick The Shining. "We've got a skeleton staff here," he said. "Our headquarters can accommodate about 5,000 people, roughly, and there are maybe 100 people here. Those halls and cubicles are empty for the same reason many airplanes are. The COVID-19 pandemic has changed every aspect of life for the past 6 months." Kelly, who succeeded Southwest founder Herb Keller in 2008, spoke with the Dallas Morning News on Thursday about how the airline, known for its upbeat attitude and friendly service, is handling the toughest financial crisis in aviation history. His answers have been edited for brevity and clarity. "How do you see the flying experience now? I've only flown Southwest, and the Southwest experience has been phenomenal. Everybody has to wear a mask, and we don't book the middle seat effectively right now. We've got all our cleaning protocols in place, and the customers are very happy. The feedback that we get from the people that fly is record levels of satisfaction. The operation is running very smooth, very much on time. And it's a pleasure to fly. You can also get a good low fare. We're in the seventh month of the pandemic. How would you describe where the airline industry is today?" "Oh gosh, the effect has been catastrophic. There's no other way to think about it. It's truly a pandemic in the greatest sense of the word. The effect on travel and tourism and services in general has been catastrophic. I don't think that it's shocking that we are where we are. You go back to the spring, and a lot of it was so new for the United States. People were wondering whether this was going to be more like a seasonal flu. I was reluctant to make any predictions in the spring about what would happen. I'm more of a planner rather than a prognosticator. All we could do is try to establish boundaries for planning, especially when the federal government came through with the CARES Act. It provided us with some breathing room. We made radical adjustments and changes to the airline. We know a lot more seven months in than we knew 1 week in. I believe we're going to have to muddle through this until we get a vaccine and until we can functionally reach herd immunity. Is it frustrating to watch the pandemic drag on? It's frustrating if one lets himself get frustrated. We don't have time for that. We've got to keep our eye on the ball. We need to run a safe airline. We need to do everything we can to make sure the business survives. I need to do the best job I can to take care of our people and our customers, and we've just got to persevere. We're battle-hardened at Southwest, and we're up to the challenge. I don't see that it serves any purpose to be frustrated with things that are totally outside your control. You and other airline executives had predicted that travel would be down about 30% in the fall. That forecast isn't looking very good right now. I never predicted that. What I was sharing was that was our guess, that was our plan, knowing we could adjust it if need be. It's easier for us to cut flights than it is to add flights back. But in any event, that's way too optimistic currently because we're down twice that much. What I would predict now is that I don't see that changing significantly from now until we get a vaccine. We will see some lift at that point, and until behaviors change, people are going to have to be confident that we've reached herd immunity. Until we get to that point, I wouldn't expect us to see a significant improvement in traffic. That will be sometime in 2021 at best. Airlines for America's Nicholas Calio said there may not be a full recovery until 2024. Are you looking at the possibility of an extended 3 or 4 year recovery? It's 34 years in the business for me, and it was a long decade after 9/11, and it was a long slog after the Great Recession in 2008. Absolutely, we're prepared for a long recovery. We were very well prepared for the pandemic coming into it with record low levels of debt. We had plenty of cash, and we boosted our cash reserves dramatically this year, and we're working on adjusting our cost structure. We've already got a low-cost structure in the first place, and very well suited to serve the leisure side of the market in addition to the business travel market. But I'm certainly not bullish that business travel is going to bounce right back. In fact, I would argue that relative to a normal recession and recovery scenario, this will be twice as long. I wouldn't be surprised to see business travel languish for a decade before it gets back to 2019 levels. So yes, we will be prepared for that. Do you think you'll continue spacing out seating when it's not profitable to do so? I don't think we can do it indefinitely. I agree with that. I think our customers understand that. What we hear from them is that they're very comfortable with what we're doing. Obviously, middle seats are an element of that. Right now, we're interested in learning more about the science of physical distancing on the airplane, given all of the other layers of safety and health protection that are in place. In the end, it's all about what customers are comfortable with. Customers are really happy with the Southwest promise today. I am not really prepared to say when we might change, but at some point, yes, absolutely, we will have to get our business back. It's just going to have to be at the right time. Southwest had 28% of employees take voluntary leave or early retirement. Why do you think that they are so willing to do so when the global economic outlook is uncertain? It's not just one thing that went into people's decisions. It was probably a handful of things. And with some people, maybe more. You have a lot of people that really answered the call. They could do this personally from their own financial perspectives. And they could help out their family members here at Southwest. It was also a reflection of the generosity in terms of the offer. If you were thinking about retiring over the next several years and you had this pretty lucrative offer, for a lot of people, it'd be crazy to pass it up. I suspect there were a lot of people who understood this and that it's a really tough time. I'm not sure exactly what kind of effort and sacrifice it's going to take, and I might not be up for that. That's fair, too, because we're going to need all hands on deck to get through this crisis. Our folks are going to have to work really, really hard. I was pleased with that result because it certainly helps us cut our cost down and we're able to take care of our people and not force any involuntary furloughs. What is the possibility of avoiding furloughs in early 2021 as the pandemic continues? If things don't improve, this just can't continue. We can't lose the kind of cash we lost in the second quarter for quarter upon quarter upon quarter. We'll be out of business. A lot depends on the revenue environment improving. That's front and center of why we are announcing Miami and Palm Springs, because it will help chip away at the revenue deficiency. There are still some levers we can pull, but the vaccine has got to come online and it's got to work. We've got to begin to get back to normal, or else we're just talking about a completely different catastrophic scenario for the airline industry and other industries for that matter as well. Are the next 6 months going to be just as damaging as the last six? I think we're past the dark days of March and April, and things have been pretty stable since July 4th. We went into a stall when the COVID-19 cases sharply spiked in early July, which was a shame because we were on a pretty good trajectory. People were feeling more comfortable with travel. The good news is it's pretty stable. Stable's good, but we're at unsustainable levels and it can't go on indefinitely. Beyond the self-help steps taken, what is the government going to do in terms of creating a CARES Act 2 and what will be there in it for continuing the payroll support for airlines. That is a major bearing on our outlook for the next 6 months. Our visibility is not very far into the future. It's pretty easy to predict that we shouldn't expect much improvement in 2020, but I'm still hopeful about the first quarter of next year. We'll continue to press Congress and the administration for CARES too. I think that would be very helpful to the country, not just the airlines, but to the whole country. We're in a situation that absent some kind of sovereign effort for liquidity, the country goes into depression. No company can be prepared for an almost total loss of revenue and customers. The only way through that is temporary trough is with assistance from the government.
Here's now a locally written article from the Midland Reporter-Telegram. This was a front-page story from Monday, September 7th. Economic impact. Marfa struggles to strike a balance between tourism and coronavirus.
This article is entitled, Marfa Struggles to Strike a Balance Between Tourism, Coronavirus, by Alfredo Corchada, Dallas Morning News. Marfa. For much of its history, this town in West Texas has been known as much for its wide-open skies as its big heart. Then, of course, there are those mysterious lights. This year, the famous lights may still shine somewhere off on the majestic horizon, but COVID-19 has forced the town to cancel the annual Marfa Lights Festival held over the Labor Day weekend, which usually features food trucks, live music, and plenty of dancing. Two of Marfa's favorite sons, Tim Johnson and Primo Carrasco, lamented the news during their weekly Dos Horas Regional Norteño Music program last week on Marfa Public Radio. They also reminded listeners not to forget to take COVID-19 precautions. This will be a sad time here in Marfita, Carrasco said in Spanish, adding that this year there will be no music. We won't have anything, but we wish you nothing but the best this Labor Day. Wash your manitas, hands, keep your distance, and wear a face mask. Johnson added, we all look forward to a time when we can all be together and celebrate Marfa Lights. Marfa, a town of about 1,800 people, takes its many celebrations to heart. It's been that way for generations. But this small, mostly Mexican-American town turned arts hub couldn't escape the impact of the pandemic, which has devastated entire economies and lives worldwide. The pandemic puts the striking region in a quandary. Nestled on a high plateau in the northern Chihuahuan Desert, Marfa is surrounded by gems that lure tourists from everywhere. Big Bend National Park is to the southeast, and to the north lies the McDonnell Observatory, which, until the pandemic, would host stargazing parties. In between are striking, quirky communities, from Presidio on the border to Ojinaga, Alpine, Marathon, and Fort Davis, all under skies that take the breath and worries away. But the visitors that are the source of local livelihoods also threaten a spike in COVID-19 cases. So far, Marfa, which lies in Presidio County, hasn't recorded any COVID-19 deaths within the county, although at least three people have died in the closest hospitals, some 3 hours away in El Paso and Midland, Odessa. Presidio County has reported about 80 coronavirus cases since March, said David Beebe, Justice of the Peace for Precinct 1, but the lack of medical care puts the region in a vulnerable position. Locals walk a fine line between welcoming to visitors and worrying about them spreading the deadly infection, he said. So we're not saying stay away from here, this is our place, not yours, Beebe said. That's not who we are or what we want to do. But the healthier we stay, the more we'll be able to continue to welcome everybody, because we want to continue sharing the beauty of solitude, where skies are really big and the sound of trains are beautiful. Others aren't so thrilled about welcoming visitors during a pandemic. Last spring, native son Daniel O. Hernandez, a state legislative assistant for Texas Democratic Senator Jose Rodriguez, penned an open letter to the Houston Chronicle titled, Stay Home, Marfa's Closed. Rodriguez took issue with the Chronicle's Where to Go Glamping across Texas. Especially offensive to some locals was the opening line, Self-quarantine? No problem. Texas has its share of upscale, high-end hotels and opulent, sprawling ranches. Hernandez suggested visitors can support Marfa by going online and buying gift certificates or merchandise, or just being extra careful about not spreading the virus. It's easy for others to talk about opulence and affluence when they're hundreds of miles away from here, but you know what? My dad and brother work in hospital quality. My mom is a food service director of the school, he said. Rodriguez reminds visitors that essential workers are mostly local Mexican-Americans or Mexicans from nearby Ojinaga. They, along with communities of color, represent the most vulnerable population that's succumbing to the virus in Texas and beyond. Marfa, in some sense, is very affluent and does very well in terms of attracting high-end tourists who like to spend money, stay in nice hotels, he said. But at the end of the day, it is still Latinos who are the ones that are the cooks and the servers and the dishwashers and the hotel clerks and the housekeepers who are keeping the town going. They are the central essential workers, and we need to take care of them. Walking that fine line has been difficult. Tourism and livelihood go hand in hand. The economic consequences have been especially devastating. For now, the streets are mostly empty. Many businesses remain closed, and it's not entirely clear whether they'll reopen. Others show signs of life. Marfa is still open, and we're glad to have folks here, said Emily Williams, general manager at the Hotel St. George. We're glad to have folks at the hotel, dining with us, or at the pool. Across Marfa, I think everyone just appreciates all of our guests remembering that it's people's home, too. Marfa is not just to get away. While a lot of people depend on visitors, we're depending on you to keep it safe and healthy. Labor Day weekend is particularly meaningful here. The Marfa Lights Festival is the main attraction, featuring that strange phenomenon of yellowish orbs spotted hovering in the sky. People park along roadsides in lawn chairs and stare out at the wide-open skies, their eyes trained on the area. For locals, the Marfa Lights Festival also is a homecoming weekend of sorts, beckoning former residents to spend time with their families. They flock to the historic Presidio County Courthouse with its pink stucco and luscious green lawn. The event marks the unofficial end of summer and ushers in autumn and a host of events. The biggest is the Chinati Foundation's annual weekend event, where all of artist Donald Judd's installations open for self-guided viewing, and the museum presents special exhibitions, talks, and performances, all free to the public, according to its official website. This year's event, set for October 10th to 11th, will be virtual. The two festivals are a fusion of Marfa's local and newcomers, a mixture of folklore and fine arts. Marfa, some say, has been humbled by the pandemic, as local residents rely more on each other than tourists or transplants, many of whom are easily spotted, sporting brand new jeans and new cowboy boots and 10-gallon hats. We're finding our way through this little by little, returning to our roots, our own character, because we're mostly alone, sadly without many visitors, said Ramona Tejada, cook at one of the town's most beloved institutions, Marfa Burrito. Her wall of fame includes pictures of celebrities from Matthew McConaughey to Mark Ruffalo. It's up to us to push our community forward. In addition to his radio show, Johnson is a longtime resident and organizer of events, including the Agave Marfa Festival Marfa and Desert Encrypts, both of them canceled. He's also owner of Marfa Book Company and Gallery, where business is down by about 85%, he said. Still, amid the turbulent times, Johnson sees a silver lining, a moment to debate, if not reclaim, Marfa's identity, an identity that at times seems to stray too far toward the hipster, glamorous, overly high-priced way. The pandemic has given us an opportunity, I think, to hopefully reground ourselves in our relationship with our community. How do we keep true to who we are without living up to the image which we find in the New York Times, which we've always felt was a little bit always somewhat inaccurate. At some point, he said, our image kind of got a little bit away from us. This article is distributed by Tribune Content Agency.
And finally, from our volunteer readings today, here's another article from the Midland newspaper published on September 7th. This is from the opinion page. Jobs numbers have a way to go.
This column is entitled Jobs Numbers Have a Way to Go by Henry Olson, Washington Post. Friday's unemployment figures are yet more proof that the U.S. economy is roaring back. They also show, however, that there are limits to the nation's recovery so long as the fear of the novel coronavirus remains. The headline unemployment rate's rapid decline to only 8.4% is the big news. It was 14.7% just 4 months ago, and millions more people weren't counted as unemployed then because they had dropped out of the labor force. Nearly 14 million Americans have gone back to work since the height of the pandemic shutdowns. That's a stunning rebound that President Donald Trump will surely tout. The recovery would likely be stronger if it were not for some states continuing COVID-19 restrictions. Most of California, which represents nearly 12% of the nation's population, remains under severe restrictions that limit most retail stores and restaurants. New Jersey reopened its restaurants and movie theaters only on Friday, and then at only 25% capacity. New York City still bans indoor dining, and both Pennsylvania and Washington State restrict indoor dining to 50% or less capacity in their most populous counties. All of these restrictions keep employment in the heavily hit restaurant industry below levels seen in other states. The country needs to add roughly another 11 million jobs to be back at pre-pandemic employment levels. If the recovery continues at its current pace, employment is up by an average of 3.5 million per month since April, according to the household survey, the nation would be back to normal by Christmas. The underlying data from the employer survey, however, shows why that's not likely to happen. While employment is down in nearly all sectors of the economy, much of the remaining shortfall is in the leisure and hospitality sector. Employment in that sector remains roughly 4 million people below the levels of a year ago. That number barely budged last month, and it won't surge until people feel safe going to restaurants, bars, and movie theaters at pre-pandemic levels. That's not likely to happen anytime soon. The continued closure of schools, colleges, and daycare centers is also seriously depressing employment. The employer survey lumps people in these fields into four categories: educational services, child daycare services, state government education, and local government education. And the number of workers in these fields remains nearly 1 million lower than it was a year ago. These people won't be coming back to work until the nation's schools and daycare centers are open and running at full capacity. Continued fears associated with reopening these entities, which require people mingling indoors at close quarters, will keep employment down for the foreseeable future. Other dark spots pop up with a closer look at the data. Employment in the motion picture and transportation industries remains significantly down from a year ago. Some types of retail stores, such as department stores and big warehouse superstores, are bouncing back. But employment in clothing, sports apparel, and smaller retail stores remains significantly down. Temporary health services have lost more than 500,000 jobs since last year, and myriad sectors that support office work have also lost hundreds of thousands of jobs. It's again difficult to see how these sectors recover fully without people feeling comfortable going back to the office, taking public transit or airplane trips, and shopping in line in person at stores for goods they could buy online. None of these problem areas should detract from the good news. Millions of people are back to work and enjoying the financial and personal benefits of something more akin to normal life. It could have been different, and we should be thankful for what we achieved. Political leaders from both parties, however, need to be prepared for the hard work that lies ahead. the economy will soon be bumping up against a ceiling that will prevent employment from rising much higher. That means we will be experiencing something more like the jobless recovery of the early 2000s, when stock markets rose while unemployment remained stubbornly high, as opposed to the white-hot labor market of the past few years. Solving that challenge will require policy innovation and a lot of government money. The good news is that much of the country has experienced the V-shaped recovery Trump sought. The bad news is that it's going to take more than letting the free market's animal spirits run wild to get back to where we were.
Millions of Americans are likely to spend this fall accumulating unpaid bills for the rent. The people concerned about eventual mass evictions include one of the top stewards of the U.S. economy. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell spoke with NPR earlier this month.
We don't want, and we shouldn't allow them, in my view, as a country. We shouldn't let those people lose everything they have and have to move out or be evicted and move in with family. So I do think we ought to do everything we can as a country to keep those people, I won't say make them whole, but I would say to look out for them. It could have significant macroeconomic effects over time, but it's also just the right thing to do.
Steve Inskeep talked with a financial columnist who has tried to game out what happens next.
For Michelle Singletary, the starting point for understanding this sweeping national story is what it's like to experience a single eviction. She recalls witnessing one before the pandemic.
A mother with three children were put out, and she knew that, you know, she was having trouble. And my sister was her coworker, and she called me because I have a van to come help. And it just, I tell you, it just breaks your heart. These three little children, and they just take everything out of your home. There's no systematic way about this. And they just put it on the sidewalk. And you have to, first of all, try to figure out how to pack all the most essential things up. And then people are coming along and picking up the possessions. So you have to actually have people stationed to prevent other people from taking things that are on the street.
Singletary wants to avoid witnessing that scene on many sidewalks. She is a personal financial columnist for the Washington Post, and she is watching for a crisis that has not quite arrived, although some cities have seen evictions. Federal rent and mortgage aid kept most people in their homes last spring. Congress failed to agree on an extension this summer, but the Centers for Disease Control ordered a stop to evictions for public health reasons through the end of this year. Eventually, though, there will be a problem. It sounds like we are going to reach a point where, if you're renting, if you're owning, someone is going to say, I need the year of back payments. I need the 9 months of back payments, whatever it is.
That's right. And so once those moratoriums end and landlords can get into court and evict people for non-payment, there's going to be a huge crisis of folks figuring out where to live.
Somebody might be listening and saying, listen, millions of people have been getting unemployment insurance, and for a while there was extra unemployment insurance. People should have been paying the rent. Do you accept that idea?
Well, I think it's very frustrating when people say, well, they've been getting all this money. I mean, recognize that unemployment benefits, you know, barely made it for some folks. So it's they couldn't necessarily pay the full rental payment or put food on the table. The extra $600 that was available under the CARES Act, which has since ended, helped a lot of folks who were already behind. I mean, it's not as if people were sitting back, kicking their legs up, thinking, I'm in heaven because I've got all this extra money. They were making less to begin with, many people making just the minimum wage, which is not enough to live on. So they were, you know, they weren't getting a bonus. This money helped them live the way they should have been living.
It would be tempting to say landlords should just let people stay. Is that a realistic option?
The fact of the matter is many landlords are just regular folks renting out homes that they used to have or rooms in their homes or you know, units. They don't have these multi-complex, maybe they don't have all this money set aside in a bank account. And many landlords use those rental payments to pay their mortgages on the properties. So you can see that puts them in jeopardy. Even landlords are living paycheck to paycheck or rental payment to rental payment.
So we are facing this moment, which is coming, when people are going to face large amounts of back rent that they can't really pay, to landlords who maybe really need the large amounts of back rent or they can't really pay their mortgages. What's a way out of chaos at that point?
Well, there was, you know, the HEROES Act, which was passed by the House, did have money, substantial amount of money for rental assistance. And that pot of money included helping people pay back rent, helping people with current rental payments, helping people pay their utility bills. Because obviously, if you can't pay your rent, you may not also not be able to pay your utility bills. You know, there's a lot of concern about the federal deficit and what all this aid is going to do. And as someone who writes about personal finance and is constantly encouraging people to save and be very mindful of their money and not overexpend, I feel this deeply. I understand it from both sides. But in the times of crisis, conventional advice, things that you would normally do under normal situations, have to be put aside. You can't be telling people who don't have money for food or roof over their head, oh, we got to worry about the federal deficit. That is a problem we need to address later. But right now, before winter sets in, before the natural course of the flu sets in, we got to put something on the table to keep people in their homes.
It's risky always to try to sketch out the future. We don't really know what the future holds, but it seems like it might be valuable to imagine what an eviction crisis would look like if it ever happened. I'm thinking it wouldn't be like a hurricane where thousands of people are made homeless all at once. What do you think it would look like?
What I envision is lots of people trying to get into shelters and also trying to double and triple up with families who do have places to live, which could also spread the virus. Let's look at it, you know, an example. 100 people are evicted. 20% may have to go to a shelter and the other ones will have to try to find shelter with other families. Now you're introducing the possibility of the virus spreading in regular people's homes, because if my cousin calls and needs a place to stay, I'm taking my cousin in. But my cousin may have been in an area where the virus is spreading, and they're in communities where we know it's still spreading. And so this jeopardizes not just those people in the shelter, but people who are living in their homes within the community. And then we can see an uptick in the reported cases of COVID. So it is like a domino effect, you know, that one domino falls and then other things end up smashing down.
Michelle Singletary, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
You're listening to the Texas Standard.
In 2015, state lawmakers passed a last-minute tax break for nonprofit groups trying to increase the number of affordable housing units in Texas. But a new report out this week by the University of Texas Law School shows that private developers used it to earn a 100% property tax break. And those units, well, they're hardly affordable for what most consider to be low-income renters. Here to talk about the report and the tax incentive, Eric Dexheimer. He is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Eric, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
First, take us back to 2015. What actually happened at the end of the legislative session?
So there was a bill that had been generated in the House. It was a very complicated bill. It had to do with these organizations called public facility corporations. They're nonprofits associated with the housing authorities. But it was described by its author as a cleanup bill. That is, it was essentially updating some statutes. And it moved over to the Senate. And in the closing days of the legislative session, Senator Craig Estes from Wichita Falls proposed this one-sentence amendment, which essentially gave affordable housing developers a 100% property tax break for building units in the, you know, in the one of the cities.
100% tax breaks. I don't recall hearing a lot of discussion about this, and it doesn't seem like there was a lot of discussion on the floor either, right? I mean, how unusual is that?
Well, these things probably happen more than we'd like to think. As these sessions wrap up, there's been a lot of maneuvering by legislators to get their bills and their favorite projects into law. And so in the closing days of the session, this is what was called the floor amendment. It was discussed on the floor of the Senate. There was a single question. The question asked, would these tax breaks convey to nonprofits or to private developers? The lawmakers assembled there were assured that the tax breaks would be for nonprofits only, but it turned out to be not the case. It passed nearly unanimously. It went back to the House where it passed unanimously and was signed into law a few days later.
How big are these tax breaks?
So these are 100% property tax breaks. That means that the entire value of the land and the improvements on it are not taxed. And in addition to that, if you're building a new project, the construction materials don't have sales tax on them either.
But, of course, one of the reasons cities are willing to engage in this in the first place is that they're getting affordable housing, right?
Well, that depends on how you define affordable.
In what way?
Well, most affordable housing in this country is built by private developers, and governments give tax breaks to incentivize them. But most advocates agree that the lower income you have, the greater the need for affordable housing to be built. These units are at the very top of what most people would consider affordable housing.
In fact, you talk about people with like incomes of $60,000 being able to be eligible for these units, right?
The way that some of these deals work, that's true, that if you're a single person earning $63,000, you would qualify as someone in need of affordable housing under some of these deals.
What about people earning a lot less than $60,000? Where are they going? Are they squeezed out of the market?
There is a great need for units for people earning what's called 60% of the average median income and below. These are for 80% and above. So the units that are being built under this law using this tax break are not for those people who are earning less than, you know, 80%.
Why is this happening? Is it because of a lack of oversight? Because the law seems pretty clear that you get the tax break if you're providing affordable housing. But the question seems to be, what is affordable housing and why aren't these units going to people who need it most?
They're providing housing for people who are kind of right on the edge of needing some government subsidized housing, you know, to help them afford a place to live in the cities they are. The second reason they do it is because they say it provides some economic development. That is, if you build a housing complex in an area that hadn't seen development before, that will kind of incentivize other companies to come. So it's kind of, they promote it as this mixture of sort of affordable housing, but also economic development.
Eric Dexheimer is an investigative reporter with the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Eric, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, we will bring you a couple of articles related to incomes. American incomes were rising until the pandemic hit. And also a poll that indicates pandemic worsens minorities' income and savings. We'll also have a report on oil demand collapsing and the opinion of it won't come back anytime soon. Those stories will be tomorrow. Today, before we run out of time, we have one more report. Workers with disabilities can earn just $3.34 an hour. Agency says law needs to change.
So for 82 years, American labor law has had a carve-out for some workers with disabilities. They can be paid less than minimum wage. This was meant to encourage employment of more people. But today, a top federal civil rights watchdog says the exemption should end because it's been trapping workers in job programs that they call exploitative and discriminatory. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
Jerry D'Agostino had a job but couldn't afford a few things he wanted to do, like go out to eat sometimes.
Go to the movies, go to events.
He was working alongside other people with disabilities at a center in Rhode Island, doing what he calls bench work, rote tasks like fitting rings into heating tubes, packaging ice packs, assembling boxes for jewelry.
If I remember correctly, my first paycheck was only $12. I just questioned myself as, you know, I really don't want to keep doing bench work for my whole life.
D'Agostino now works at a supermarket where his paycheck is a lot more than $12 total. But he spent years in that center, which paid him below minimum wage thanks to that carve-out in the labor law. Centers like that are often called sheltered workshops because they keep people with disabilities in a separate cluster. Their pay is estimated to average $3.34 an hour. To calculate individual pay, the centers regularly time their workers, comparing how fast they do tasks to an experienced non-disabled worker, half as fast, half the pay. Now, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights says this program and the law should be phased out.
In short, the program doesn't work, and it is designed in a way that it can't work.
Catherine Lehman chairs the commission. She says instead of expanding opportunities, the programs limit them, don't really prepare people for work in the community, jobs with regular wages.
I was ashamed of the ways that we have operated now over 8 decades. a federal assumption that people with disabilities are less capable of full employment than people without disabilities.
A lot of data are missing about subminimum wage programs, including how many people they employ. Estimates range from 100,000 to four times that. Most have intellectual and developmental disabilities. Commonly, the programs are run by nonprofits. They get state and federal money to support these jobs. Many of them have government contracts. And their most vocal supporters are some of the workers' families who want the programs to remain an option, a safe environment for relatives with disabilities. One mother, Linda Howe from Wisconsin, testified before the Civil Rights Commission in November.
We are parents with our son's best interest at heart. Any suggestion that we would allow him to be taken advantage of or discriminated against is an insult.
Families like hers helped workshops flood the commission with a record number of comments, asking to let the programs be. Some described workers with, quote, severe disabilities, worried about where they'd go. Lehman says that is why her agency is recommending a careful, gradual phase-out. Disability rights advocates have wanted such a phase-out for years. They point to success stories of people thriving outside of the systems that underestimated them. Anil Lewis, who now fights against sheltered workshops at the National Federation of the Blind, testified about his past work running one, thinking he was doing the right thing.
And because of that misguided compassion, these individuals spend a significant part of their lives wasting away in that workshop, making money for our center, but wasting away. And I am just sitting here really feeling sad about what I perpetuated, because there is a better alternative.
Four states have abolished sheltered workshops to support more jobs in the community. Seven states have moved to end wages below the minimum. Several federal bills trying to do so on a national level have so far failed. Alina Selyuk, NPR News, Washington.
That is your coronavirus update for Thursday, September 17th, 2020. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. We'll bring you national news from USA Today coming up next, followed by local news at 3, and here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, MISD enrollment drops by nearly 1,000. Committee to hold last vote on Lehigh name. A report on Centennial Park's progress. And from the Odessa American, GOP candidates stump at Marriott. Trustees give superintendent a raise and longer contract. And a short article about the opening and schedule of this year's Fiddlesticks Farms cornfield maze. Those articles and more at 3 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, the Wall Street Journal. And then at 7 o'clock tonight, of course, we'll bring you Texas Monthly Archives, where we dig back into earlier files from Texas Monthly Stories. Tonight, we will focus on true crime. The article is from July 1996, called Poisoning Daddy, How a Loving Daughter and Star Student Stole Barium Acetate from Her High School Chemistry Lab, Put It in Her Father's Refried Beans, and Almost Got Away with Murder. That's tonight on Texas Monthly Archives, 7 o'clock tonight. We'll be back with you for our final day of the week. Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 81 and mostly cloudy. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from the USA Today, Thursday, September 17th, 2020. Starting with the money section, under the money line column, there are three items. First, global economic forecast improves. The global economy is not doing as badly as previously expected, especially in the United States and China, but has still suffered an unprecedented drop due to the coronavirus pandemic, an international watchdog said on Wednesday. the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, said in a report that the world's gross domestic product is projected to decline by 4.5% this year, less than the 6% plunge it had predicted in June. The OECD upgraded its forecast for the U.S. economy, anticipating a contraction of 3.8% this year instead of a plunge.